A word to the squeamish, this next story is pretty disgusting. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced yesterday that it would give schools the choice to order ground beef that does not contain what's known as pink slime, also known as lean beef trimmings. The USDA took action after 200,000 mothers, fathers, and concerned citizens signed a petition to get pink slime out of school cafeterias. They cited safety concerns. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, these controversial beef trimmings aren't just found in the burgers and tacos served at school. They may well be in the ground beef we buy in the grocery store.
In an attempt to find out whether some ground beef that I bought contains so-called pink slime, I called Don Schaffner for help. He's a food scientist at Rutgers, and I reached out to him at his lab.
Yeah, I can hear you. You're faint, but I can hear you.
Okay, all right. So I've got this package of meat here, and I'm looking at the label. Am I going to know by reading this label if there are any of these lean beef trimmings in here?
You won't know that by looking at the label.
Oh, so it's not labeled at all.
It's not required to be labeled at this point in time yet.
Now, according to estimates, about 70% of ground beef in the U.S. contains pink slime trimmings. And clearly, people are completely grossed out, disgusted by the phrase. It suggests an oozy, gooey liquid. The meat industry calls it lean, finely textured beef. So I asked Don Schaffner, what exactly is this stuff? He explained these bits come from fatty trimmings that also contain small amounts of muscle protein and connective tissue.
What the process does is it takes those mostly fat trimmings and heats them up so the fat becomes liquid, and then uses a process to separate the lean portion from the fat portion.
So this makes sense. You take something fatty, extract the lean part, and maybe it does look a little pink and slimy, but so does a lot of raw meat. So here's what some people say they're worried about. There are reports that the trimmings are likely to carry pathogens, such as E. coli. And Schaffner, who consults for the meat industry, says this is true.
The bacterial risk comes from the fact that these are pieces that are being cut away from the outside of the meat. And so that's where the bacteria are likely to be. So there is a possibility of an increased risk of having pathogens or even just, you know, many different types of bacteria, not just the pathogenic type, on these products.
The industry agrees. That's why it's adopted the practice of treating the meat trimmings with ammonium hydroxide gas. This kills the pathogens. But even if it solves one problem, critics say, who wants to eat beef treated with ammonia? Betsy Boreen of the American Meat Institute Foundation maintains that it's safe in the amounts that are used.
This is not the same ammonia that you might use in cleaning supplies. It's a gas. It's a different compound. So this isn't, you know, cleaning supply that's putting in. It's actually a well-established processing intervention that has a long history of success.
And is approved by the USDA. But consumer sentiment has been turning against pink slime or lean beef trimmings for a while now. The fast food industry has responded, and McDonald's announced back in January of 2011 it would no longer use ammonia-treated beef in its burgers. But given that only an estimated 30% of the ground beef supply is free of these trimmings, it may now be a challenge for schools to actually find certified ammonia-free beef. According to Chef Ann Cooper of the Boulder, Colorado School District, she's trying to buy some now, and her suppliers can't seem to get their hands on any.
They can't find any. Today, my processor on Denver can't find it for us.
Cooper says it's unclear what will happen if lots of schools and consumers start to demand hamburger meat that's free of lean, finely textured beef. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You can read more about pink slime and other more appetizing stories on NPR's food blog, The Salt. Another factor affecting food safety is the globalization of the U.S. food supply. A report by the Centers for Disease Control says foodborne disease outbreaks caused by imported food are on the rise, in part due to the doubling of food imports over the past decade. Imported food was linked to 39 outbreaks and more than 2,000 illnesses during this period, with nearly half of those outbreaks in just the last 3 years. The biggest culprits, imported fish and spice. The outbreaks were linked to 15 different countries, nearly half of those in Asia. There was a big movie premiere last night, big in the political world anyway. The largest role went to President Obama. because this movie is actually an ad of sorts, designed in hopes that it will go viral and help Mr. Obama's re-election prospects. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
This is Nora, the piano-playing cat. On YouTube, people have viewed her video 23.6 million times.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
This is the singer will.i.am. People have viewed his video 23.7 million times. One of those videos helped President Obama get elected.
Yes, we can.
One of them did not. Those two wildly popular and wildly different videos show just how difficult it can be to calculate the exact formula of a viral video. But the Obama re-election campaign has tried to master the recipe with its new 17-minute film, The Road We've Traveled.
Not since the days of Franklin Roosevelt had so much fallen on the shoulders of one president.
Hollywood star power? Check. Tom Hanks narrates. Suspense and drama? Check.
There was a screen set up for slides, but we might as well have been showing a horror movie.
This biographical film is directly related to the kinds of movies that campaigns used to make for a party's nominating convention. But the digital era makes it a new beast altogether. Becky Donatelli is a Republican social media strategist.
YouTube is the third most visited website in the world, with users of YouTube spending roughly 15, 20 minutes a day watching video. So when we want to reach people with a visual story like that, we're going online.
And it's not just a static viewing experience. The Obama team is doing everything in its power to give this video tentacles. The campaign says there were more than 300 viewing parties across the country last night. For weeks, the re-election website has encouraged people to, quote, sign up to be the first to see the full film. That sign-up information goes into the campaign's database. And the website makes it easy for you to tweet the film, post it on your Facebook page, or give money. Kambiz Lavasani is a Democratic digital strategy consultant.
So you create this cascading effect of, you know, fans of the president watching it via an email, and then you have friends of those fans who see it and then reshare it. And that's sort of what we talk about when we talk about a video going viral. It's authentic enough and that it speaks to its audience and people feel compelled to reshare it.
The goal is to ultimately reach beyond the echo chamber of enthusiastic Obama supporters to the undecided independent voters who will determine the outcome of this election. On the campaign trail, Mitt Romney has mocked the video.
The president's people have put together a 17-minute infomercial. They're calling it a documentary. I don't think so. It's an infomercial.
He dismisses the production as propaganda that ignores President Obama's failings.
I have some suggestions for the president and for the producer. First of all, talk to the 24 million Americans that are out of work or underemployed in this country.
But at the White House yesterday, spokesman Jay Carney predicted it'll have staying power.
I look forward to seeing it many times in my spare time, of which I don't have enough.
He said he doesn't know whether the president has seen it yet, and he's not aware of any plans for a White House viewing party. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
Jiro Ono has given more than 75 years of his life to one job. The sushi chef started learning his trade at the age of 9. His father had abandoned the family, forcing Jiro's impoverished mother to send him out to a Dickensian world of kitchen work. Today, his sushi restaurant, Tsukiyabashi Jiro, is considered the best in the world. So good, it's earned the top Michelin rating of 3 stars, even though it's located deep underground next to a Tokyo subway platform. Jiro presides from behind the counter, a formidable, focused presence, his hands molding the soft rice beneath delicate slices of fish. A new documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, follows the 86-year-old's almost obsessive search for the perfect sushi. The film's director, David Gelb, joined us here at NPR West. Welcome.
Thank you, Renee.
How did you get Jiro to let you follow him?
Well, I owe a great deal to the food writer Masahiro Yamamoto. I like to refer to him as a sushi poet. He was the judge of Iron Chef in Japan. He convinced Jiro that I would do a fair telling of his story.
One thing about the film that brings you in is when one first meets Jiro, you know he's amazing at what he does. You know he's the best sushi chef in the world. And yet he seems quite fierce. And bit by bit, you see this other side. He'll break out into a little smile. And it, maybe in a way that seems more of a gift.
Absolutely. When I first ate at the restaurant, I was very, very nervous because I'd heard, you know, what a serious man he is and kind of how stoic he is, and he doesn't talk to the customers, and the meal lasts 30 minutes and costs $350, and, you know, you're out of there as soon as you finish, basically. But as soon as he finished service and the customers left the restaurant, and he becomes, you know, a very personable, kind gentleman. And what I realized is that it's not that he's mean. He's just concentrating, using his full attention on the task at hand, which is making sushi. He's just focused on making every single piece of sushi the best sushi of his life.
You know, does it matter that it's such a small place? His entire restaurant consists of a bar with 10 stools?
Yeah, there are 10 seats in the bar. They do maybe one turnover for lunch and one turnover for dinner. That's all the people that he can serve to his standard, because that's all the fish that exists in the fish market that will satisfy him.
There are plenty of examples in this film of the lengths that Jiro goes to make the ultimate sushi. One of them, which he doesn't do himself, massaging the octopus. What's that?
Octopi are often tragically under-massaged in sushi restaurants.
So they, you end up chewing on them.
Yeah, well, octopus, you know, I think a lot of people that eat octopus in a normal sushi restaurant, especially Americans, you know, octopus isn't that popular because it's known as being chewy and it has kind of suction cups. And, you know, a lot of people think it's a piece of rubber. And Jiro laments that as well because he thinks that octopus often has no flavor. And so he developed a way to make octopus delicious. It needs to be massaged for an hour every day in order to both tenderize it and also to bring out the flavors of what the octopus has been eating. The octopus that they get has a fantastic diet of clams and shellfish, and so by massaging the octopus, they're unlocking all the flavor that's inside of it, and that's one of the reasons that Jiro's octopus is so delicious.
Your film takes us to this fish market. Let's take a listen to the sound of it. Describe for us what we're hearing.
This is the tuna auction, and the procedure has been unchanged for over 100 years. There's no digital record keeping of any kind. It's all, you know, completely analog. The auctioneers are ringing bells to indicate where the auctions are taking place on the floor, because there may be a few auctions happening at the same time for different fish. And the auctioneers are sort of like yelling, like in a Sotheby's, essentially. And it kind of takes on a very musical quality.
Almost like jazz. Whereas the rest of the film, there's a score that is classical music. And it seems as if you structure the story as a kind of symphony.
Certainly. And this is something that Yamamoto, our food writer and narrator, he conveyed this to me when I first started talking to him about Jiro and about sushi, is that Jiro's sushi, his sushi course is like a concerto. It's like a piece of music. And it has movements, and it has, you know, kind of hills and valleys, all very delicious, but the hills and valleys meaning the contrast and the flavors between the different sushi.
Throughout the film, we see sushi. Sushi that's extremely elegant and exquisite to look at. Even without being able to taste it, it does give one the impression that it's quite sublime.
So they're actually quite easy to shoot because you just have to point the camera from a compelling perspective, and the sushi does the work itself. First of all, just Jiro sushi, they look like jewels. You know, they are incredibly beautiful. When he places a piece of sushi on the plate, it settles into place. And Yamamoto, the food writer, describes it as the soft landing. And it's because Jiro packs the rice firmly so it retains its shape, but also very lightly so that there's air that moves within the rice.
How does it taste?
The rice is warm and fluffy, but each grain retains its perfect shape, and it's just slightly al dente at the same time. And when you put a piece of sushi in your mouth, the rice kind of poofs. Eric Repair, the French chef, described it where the rice just poofs in your mouth, and it just the flavors combine with the fish. And what's happening, the rice is elevating the fish. And when you've mastered that balance like Jiro has, the only way to describe the sensation of eating it is umami. And that's kind of the perfect balance where you just taste the true essence of the fish.
And umami was communicated by his oldest son as the experience of ah.
Of ah, exactly. Umami is just the feeling of satisfaction while eating. You just are just moved by what you eat. After having eaten there and understanding all the work that goes into it, eating a piece of sushi from Jiro is really quite emotional, especially when you know the vast labors that have gone into creating that single bite.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
David Gelb is the director and producer of the new documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And from NPR News, this is Morning Edition, produced by Nishant Dahiya. Our senior producers are Cindy Carpy and Barry Gordimer and Jim Wildman. Senior supervising producers are Kara Tallow and Tracy Wall. Our executive producer is Madeline Kasicka. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonnell. Morning Edition's theme music is written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
The writer Alain de Botton lives in Britain, and he's observed a growing number of people leaving the religion in which they were raised. Some find new faiths, others choose atheism. De Botton himself identifies as a non-believer, but that doesn't mean he rejects all religion. He looks for lessons religion can offer.
In the British Isles, religion has become something of a sideshow, even a joke. Remember, this is the land that gave us Monty Python's Life of Brian. Of all the cultural differences between the old world and the new, this is perhaps the greatest. We think it rude to talk of money or sex. You think it rude to bring up religion. In both cases, at issue is what it might take to tread on sensitivities and cause offence. Euphemisms abound in the US. Do you come from a large family? For are you Catholic? And yet, surveying the bitter religious disputes, an outsider like me thinks just one phrase, the Jefferson Bible. One of your greatest presidents famously tried to overcome the divisions between theism and atheism by rewriting the New Testament, just with all the supernatural bits left out. Thomas Jefferson's new version emphasized Jesus's wisdom, ethics, and consoling power. In so doing, he appealed to the entire nation, even those of different or no faith at all. It was a move of intellectual deafness, which I can appreciate. I was brought up an atheist, and while I still don't believe, I've lost my cynicism. Now I long only for Jefferson's spirit of conciliation. But where is that spirit now? Unfortunately, recent public discussions on religion have focused obsessively on the most polarizing point of them all, whether or not the whole thing is true. A hardcore group of believers pits themselves against an equally strong band of atheists. Think of Christopher Hitchens and Douglas Wilson's book tours, their debates so legendary they were made into the movie Collision. But, Jefferson in mind, I prefer a different tack. To me, the real issue is not whether God exists, but where one takes the argument to once you conclude that he might not. I believe it must be possible to remain an atheist and, nevertheless, to find religions sporadically interesting and comforting, and be curious as to the possibilities of importing certain of their ideas and practices into the secular realm. Ultimately, atheists need to rescue some of what is beautiful from all that no longer seems true. With Jefferson's example before us, I propose that the wisdom of the faiths belongs to all mankind, even the most rational among us, and deserves to be selectively reabsorbed by the supernatural's deepest enemies. As your great president knew, religions are, intermittently, too useful, effective, and intelligent to be abandoned simply to those who happen to believe in them.
That's Alain de Botton. He's the author of a new book called Religion for Atheists. Why are some countries rich while others are poor? Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money has been talking with economists who say their colleagues have been looking for the answer in all of the wrong places.
The question, why are some nations rich while others are poor, is the most important question in economics. And after centuries of trying to figure out the answer, economists still don't know. Until, maybe, just maybe, right now, two important economists have come out with a new book that they say, and many others agree, may offer the answer. The book is called Why Nations Fail. One of the authors, Harvard's James Robinson, says the reason economists haven't succeeded so far is that they've been so obsessed with mathematical models of fictional economies that don't actually exist.
Economists sort of locked themselves into a straitjacket, you know, in the late 19th century. And one of the things that was out of economics was politics. The more and more I read about problems of development in Africa or Latin America or wherever it was, politics just seems so central to understanding what was going on.
To those of us who are not economists, this radical idea seems pretty obvious. Yeah, politics, of course, plays a huge role in why some countries are poor and others aren't. But economists kept looking to things that Robinson and his co-author, MIT's Daron Acemoğlu, say are secondary, like the existence or absence of natural resources or how healthy the population is. The two authors became renowned for a series of papers that showed in the clear mathematics that economists like that politics is not a secondary thing. It is the core driver explaining different levels of wealth. What Robinson and Acemoğlu did is they scoured the world for populations or geographic areas that are very similar. They're similar in almost every respect except for one thing. They are on opposite sides of an arbitrary political border. Here's Daron Acemoğlu.
Korea. So, you know, Korea was an unusually homogeneous country linguistically, ethnically, culturally, historically. At the 38th parallel, you have a border drawn. And then, you know, the next subsequent 50 years, you see the two parts of it diverge to such an extent that today, you know, the income gap between the South and the North is over tenfold.
The two Koreas may be an extreme example, but you can see very similar things on the border of the U.S. and Mexico, in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and dozens of other neighboring countries. In all of these cases, the people and land are fairly similar, but the border changed everything.
It's all about institutions. It's really about human-made systems, rules, regulations, formal or informal, that create different incentives.
When these guys talk about institutions, they mean the word as broadly as possible. It's the formal rules and laws, but it's also the norms and common practices of a society. Acemoğlu and Robinson say the key difference between rich countries and poor ones is the degree to which a country has institutions that keep a small elite from grabbing all the wealth. Think of a poor farmer in Haiti or the Congo today. Sure, he could maybe irrigate his land and till the soil and grow more stuff, but he knows that the institutions in place guarantee that some well-connected member of the elite is going to show up and claim the spoils. So what's the point? The poor have no incentive to invest in land or businesses or to accumulate savings. The result? Undeveloped land in a poor nation.
Ultimately, what needs to change is that those countries have to make a transition to having inclusive institutions. And that's not something that throwing money at them can achieve. That's a sort of social, political transformation in society.
This can seem discouraging, but their message does offer hope. Poverty is not the inevitable result of bad geography, bad culture, bad history. It's the result of us, of the ways that people choose to organize their societies. And that means we can change things. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
Literature is full of explorers, people who sail across oceans, tunnel deep into caves, or travel through time. Writer Gregory Crouch likes to read about a particular kind of pioneer, those who ventured into the skies. And that's his theme for our series, Three Books.
Today, it's like riding a bus. But it wasn't always that way. Vaulted from the sands of Kitty Hawk and freed from its military background by the end of the Great War, aviation soared into the 1920s and 30s on a direct course to tomorrow. Here are three flyers who not only helped open the skies, but also brought literary gems back from the cutting edge of progress, from a time when flying was the most exciting thing in the world. In 1931, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, wife of America's biggest celebrity, served as radio operator in the back of her husband's plane on a voyage into the unknown. She chronicled the adventure in her book, North to the Orient. The Lindberghs dropped in on fur trappers, Eskimos, and missionary settlers in the frozen wilds of Canada and Alaska. They crossed the Bering Sea from Nome and visited Soviet outposts. But the book's climax comes in China, where the Lindberghs surveyed the devastation caused by the 1931 flood. Her harrowing passages about the large, chillingly tranquil lake submerging the lives and homes of millions is surely one of the best descriptions of flood ever written. Only from the air could one comprehend the devastation. North to the Orient won the National Book Award for General Nonfiction in 1935. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's classic Wind, Sand, and Stars carried off the award 4 years later. Believe it or not, before he wrote his much-beloved children's story, The Little Prince, Saint-Exupéry was a professional pilot for a French airmail company, braving storms and mountains, Saharan deserts, windswept steppes, and the brutal horrors of the Spanish Civil War. Genuine magic animates his pen, and through him, we suffer the perils of stormy skies, ache with the cold of the Andes, and revel in the magic of lonely nights aloft amid a glitter of stars. Ernest K. Gann, author of Fate is the Hunter, picks up where Saint-Exupéry left us in the late 1930s. Gann takes us through his professional apprenticeship on domestic commercial routes. Often, the flights weren't even close to routine, as his story of being caught by a violent thunderstorm makes apparent. Once, during the Second World War, Gann found himself in northeastern India flying the notorious Hump over the Himalayas, delivering supplies to China. High mountains, volatile weather, and Japanese fighter planes made this one of the most dangerous aerial undertakings of the war, even though it wasn't considered a combat operation. In 1 day on the Hump, Gann witnessed the loss of 4 airplanes and 32 men. Gann and Lindbergh survived their flying careers and died at advanced ages, but fate caught Saint-Exupéry in its talons. His plane disappeared in the summer of 1944. He'd known the risks, and it's hard to imagine him wanting it any other way. As a friend of his had observed, it's worth it. It's worth the final smash-up.
That's writer Gregory Crouch. He's the author of China's Wings, War, Intrigue, Romance, and Adventure in the Middle Kingdom During the Golden Age of Flight.